Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host and my co-host from Imagine Publicity to Lila Jones. And on tonight's show, we bring you a very interesting guest this evening, a hostage negotiator by the name of Derek Vaughn. So good evening, everyone. Second time, I welcome you on this Saturday evening. It's always a pleasure to have every one of you, whether you're a returning listener or a brand new guest. We're so glad you're here, and we hope that we accomplish our mission of both educating you, increasing your awareness, and perhaps entertaining you. And with that, I'd like to say good evening, Delilah. Happy Saturday, and don't tell anyone I told you, but happy birthday. How are you?
I'm great. I'm older now.
And you're now older now?
Yes, you've let the cat out of the bag, so
thank you, though. I couldn't help myself. And so how's your day been?
Very good. Very good.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. And you're one of my special people, so I just have to say happy birthday. And hopefully we're going to have a nice week planned. Just to let people know, next week I am going to be broadcasting from South Carolina. So, and we're going to carry on as always. No matter where I am, what I'm doing, the show goes on, as they say in showbiz. But this evening, I'm very, very happy to have Derek on because he's one of my new LinkedIn friends, and we have to give a plug to LinkedIn, don't we, Delilah? Because I think there's so many high-quality professional people there, and that's how I got introduced to Derek, and he was very hospitable to take the time and the interest to be on our show, and that's what we love. And I think this is a new topic for any of our shows in Inside Lens, is it not?
Yeah, this is the first time we've had someone like Derek on, so I'm ready to hear what he has to say. I think it's going to give us a lot of information that about things that we probably, as just average people, haven't considered.
Yeah, for sure. Let me just give a little thumbnail sketch of his bio, and then we'll bring him in. And it's a very impressive one. Derek Gaunt has 24 years of law enforcement experience, 16 of that as a member of hostage negotiation team in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. And currently, he's the managing director for law enforcement training with the Black Swan Group, a negotiating consulting firm in the same city. He's supervised or negotiated over 40 hostage barricade incidents, and maybe we'll get to know what that means. Been a case presenter for Crisis Negotiations Unit for the FBI and Quantico, founder of the Metropolitan Area Crisis Negotiators Association. Has done a plethora of trainings in many different capacities and many different areas, as well as there's a publication out that he did on advice on handling hostage negotiations this January 2013. So if he'd like to expound upon that, that'd be great. Tara, I just want to say thank you so much for joining us on Shattered Life. It's a pleasure to have you.
It's a pleasure to be here, Donna, and I'd like to thank you and Delilah as well for the invitation. Looking forward to it.
Oh, well, yeah, it's totally our pleasure, and we love to have new topics and new guests on, and I think we're going to learn a lot this evening. So with that said, and your varied background, can you give us – why don't we just kind of paint a picture of what you did prior to coming to Black Swan and how your law enforcement experience kind of dovetailed into hostage negotiation.
Sure. So I'm just completing my 25th year in law enforcement, segueing into the private sector with Black Swan. I became involved with Black Swan in 2010. Black Swan is a negotiations consulting firm in the District of Columbia, as you stated, with a focus on teaching corporations and business executives how to establish and or enhance their negotiation capabilities within their company. And as a hostage negotiator, and even as a layman, it's very difficult for people to get their heads around how a hostage negotiator can apply practices in business negotiation. In fact, it's a topic that Chris Voss, who founded the company, had a hard time selling me on, because my question was the same as most of everyone else's, is how is it that the communication skills that I use, which I use to save people's lives, can be applied to the business world?
Mm-hmm.
And when you consider that some of the same factors that influence business negotiations, high stakes, the heightened emotions, little prep time, outside influences, satisfying multiple parties, those are the same factors that influence what I do as a hostage negotiator. The stakes for the business usually are monetary. The stakes for me, someone's life is on the line.
Mm-hmm.
But the stakes are in a relative context, the same. And so when you couple that fact with our success rate in the U.S., when hostage negotiators are brought to bear at a crisis incident, we have, I think the last stat I saw was 93.6% success rate. And I would put that success rate against the success rate of any, quote, business negotiator when it comes to comparing how they close deals or how good they are at persuading clients. And, mm-hmm. and when you look at it through that prism, it's easy to see why what we do should be adopted by those in the business community, and that's the premise of the business.
Derek, when you say the 93 or close to 95% success rate, are you talking about the negotiation with respect to the dealing with the hostage situation or when you're working in other venues?
No, in the arena of hostage negotiation, where we're trying to save lives, we have a 93% success rate of getting the people out that we've been brought there to save.
Okay, so that is extremely high. Wow, that's absolutely wonderful. You know, and I wouldn't have thought it would be that high. And I know that when we talked earlier in the week, there are many things that we wanted to stress the importance of, and particularly the fact that maybe we want to, from the get-go, dispel some of the myths that we've seen on in the media with respect to television shows and movies that portray that. And I think one of the things you said was that, you know, the person on the phone gets all the glory, but yet there's a lot of other things going on. Can you talk about that a bit?
Sure. I like to equate it, and just recently I watched a piece on some of our brave military snipers that are in foreign countries doing the work of the United States government. And one of the snipers said that for every shot that he takes, there's a multitude of people behind him that made that shot possible. And that's equivalent to how I view hostage negotiations. The primary negotiator is the one that's on the phone. He or she is the liaison between the government and the person on the inside, and that is the focal point. So when he surrenders, it's that primary negotiator who gets the pat on the back as to doing a great job. But there are so many more people that are supporting what that negotiator is doing. Talking on the phone is only one small piece of our job.
Can you give us some examples of what the behind-the-scenes people would be doing?
For example, sitting right next to a primary negotiator is a coach. That coach is supposed to monitor the negotiations, monitor the stress levels of the primary negotiator, provide intelligence information that we're gathering on the outside to the primary negotiator, provide tips and suggestions as to where the dialogue should go next. Immediately next to the coach or within that same room is a scribe, and that scribe is taking down bullet points on a timeline relative to the conversation and the progress of the incident. Next to that person is a person who is working what we call situation boards. Situation boards are dry erase boards where we capture relative information that the primary and the coach can refer to at a glance to remind them of certain things that are important to the resolution of the incident. And then I have a team leader who is monitoring everything that's going on inside that room. And then outside of that room, I've got four or five trained negotiators who are gathering intelligence information about the incident, the location, the persons involved, the weapons, the medical history, the criminal history, the mental history of the people involved. And then I have a supervisor on the scene who is managing all of what I just described. And then I am in the command post with the incident commander managing the negotiations aspect of the entire incident. So you do the math. I just rattled off probably 8 to 11 different positions in addition to the primary negotiator that have been brought to bear at a crisis incident to bring it to a successful resolution.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Derek, do you find that in each of these cases, a hostage case, are there similarities in, or are there things that come to a case like this that is going to be the same across the board? Or is each hostage case totally different?
I can answer that by saying yes to both. Each one is different. They bring a commonality. One of the main commonalities is emotion. There is emotion tied to every negotiation that we go to. The emotional level is different depending on the circumstances, but crazy, criminal, or crusader are the categories that we use to place these individuals in.
Crazy, criminal, crusader?
The three C's. Crazy, criminal, crusader. Those three all bring with them a certain level of emotion. And it's going to be greater for some than others. But the point I'm trying to make is that as negotiators, we're going to attack the emotional aspects of the incident as the subject sees them in order to begin to influence his decision-making. And we can't influence that decision-making until we deal with the emotions that he has attached to the incident.
Mm-hmm. And you were saying to me the other day how it's so important that you try to establish empathy with whatever the situation is, right? So you ask certain questions, you perform active listening, then you ask certain questions to draw out information. Is that right?
That's correct. It's critical for us to establish an atmosphere of respect with the individual, i.e. empathy, to view the world through their eyes. Whatever is important to them is what we need to focus on. Whether it makes sense to us or not is irrelevant. Our
mm-hmm.
job is to create that atmosphere of respect. By using active listening skills, I can demonstrate empathy. It doesn't mean that I agree with him or her. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that I necessarily like him or her. But it means that I understand that because of the circumstances, they look at the world in this certain way, and it caused them to react in this fashion. And so once I've demonstrated that empathy, I can then establish rapport, that relationship of mutual trust and respect. Once I have rapport, then I can begin to influence. And once I begin to influence, then I can get them to change their behavior, to get them to do something they're not doing, or to not stop doing something that they're doing. And mm-hmm. At the end of the day, as negotiators, we are the ultimate compliance professional. The difference between us and people in the corporate world who are compliance professionals, is we're selling jail time. And we get people to buy it all of the time.
Are there, is it more difficult to establish the rapport with the crazy or the criminal or the crusader? Does it, are all these things, as well as how long it takes, are they individual? Or can you say it's easier to establish the rapport with the crusading personality?
It's harder with the crusader, with someone who has an ideological cause or a philosophical cause.
Really?
That's deep-rooted in getting a message across to a mass population.
Oh, I guess crazy. That leaves me out. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Crusader is the hardest. I wouldn't have thought of that.
Crazies are difficult because they are usually suffering from mental illness that precludes them from being able to view the world in a rational way.
And to reason, yeah. Uh-huh.
The criminals are the easiest to deal with if it is an instrumental criminal. Now, you're going to say, what do you mean by instrumental criminal? I mean that criminal who is holding a hostage to force the fulfillment of a substantive demand on us as law enforcement. The criminal can be broken down into two categories, the instrumental, as I just described, and the expressive. The expressive criminal is the one who is acting purely on emotion. So to kind of clarify that a little bit, I want you to walk with me into Scenarioville, okay? And I'm going to give you two.
Okay.
And I'll ask you guys which one you think would be more difficult for us as negotiators to deal with. Scenario A is this. An officer who's just marked in service, gotten into his patrol car and says, you know what, I need to go get some coffee. I need some fuel for the beginning of the shift, so I'm going to go get some coffee. He pulls into a convenience store parking lot just in time to see a guy pulling his mask down and walking in, presumably to rob the place. Bad guy sees the officer, immediately grabs the clerk around the neck, points the gun at the clerk, and then says to the officer through the window, don't come in here. Okay, you got that?
Yeah.
That's scenario A. Scenario B is we get a call from a person who says, a coworker of mine just got out of her car. Her estranged husband was waiting for her in the parking lot. He pushed a gun into her back. He marches her into her place of business. He points the gun at the receptionist and says, call 911, and then takes the estranged wife into a back storeroom. Okay, those are the two scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
Which one do you think is more difficult for me to deal with? Scenario A or scenario B?
Delilah, I'll let you take this because I think I heard this the other day.
Oh,
I'm putting you on the spot.
I'm thinking A, simply because the whole situation is unplanned. With situation B, this husband or boyfriend has got this all planned out. And if you've seen enough of these types of situations happen, you can know that pattern of conduct. What is he going to do? How far would he go? But with number A, you don't know anything whatsoever about just walking in some random guy taking a clerk.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Fair enough. Fair enough. The correct answer, Delilah, is going to be B. That is the one that causes me, as a commander of my hostage negotiations team, the most problem. And when I explain to you why, you'll have that aha moment.
I'm sure
so
I will.
let's take a look at scenario A. The person inside of, and you hit it right on the head, it was an unplanned event. He didn't wake up that morning and say, you know what, I think I'm going to go to 7-Eleven and take a hostage. He said, I'm going to go to 7-Eleven and rob the store. And somewhere along the way, someone got in between him and his goal. He still has the instinct for self-preservation. He still wants to live. I can work with that. I'm not telling you that the clerk behind the counter is not in any danger, because clearly he is. Someone's pointing a gun at him. But the big reason why B, or the big reasons why B causes me more concern as a negotiator, is the emotional attachment between the person doing the holding and the person being held. In scenario A, there's no emotional attachment. He doesn't know that clerk. That clerk is a stranger to him. In scenario B, the person was specifically chosen, and there has been a previous romantic involvement. Romance involves a lot of emotion, and the emotional element tied to that incident puts that woman in grave danger. But I'll ask you, Delilah, why else do you think there's other tidbits of information I gave you in that scenario that would put that into a high-risk category for me? Number one is the relationship, but what else did I give you?
Well, the emotional end of it, and because of the fact that this guy has got it all planned out and he's willing to go all the way, and we see it happen every day. He'll take anybody and everybody out, including himself.
You hit the nail on the head. He planned this. He waited for her to get there. And and one more. There was one more tidbit of information that puts this into the hair standing up on the back of your neck category.
Well, they asked to call the police in.
That's right. He called us there. He has indicated by that action that he wants a confrontation with law enforcement. So those are the two categories of criminals that we deal with. And the people that fall into the category of scenario A are much easier for us to deal with. Category B.
Well, Derek, I have a question with A. If that person doesn't know the clerk from Adam, and if I were to play devil's advocate, I'd say, well, that's all the more reason for them to say, you know, I don't know this person. I don't care about him. I'm indifferent. Whereas with the, you know, some people's logic would say, because I have the emotional attachment of the other person, perhaps you can convince them to, you know, back off from the situation. Whereas the other one, because they have no emotional attachment, there's nothing to lose, and they'll shoot that person because they don't know him at all. Or am I wrong?
That's a good point, but we look at it in the totality of the circumstances.
Okay.
Scenario A, if the police officer had not shown up, would the clerk have been taken hostage? And the chances are no. If the guy was never interrupted, in scenario A, if he was never interrupted while committing that crime, would the hostage have been taken? The answer is no. He would have gotten his money and gotten out. He took the hostage once he saw the police officer. Why?
Yep.
Because the police represent arrest. Yes? And so
yep.
He takes the hostage because the officer represents arrest, i.e., I don't want to be arrested, i.e., I don't want to lose my freedom, i.e., I want to live as I've been living. And so that is an indication to us that he still has self-preservation on the mind, and he recognizes that the person he's holding is leverage, means to an end. And the focus is staying alive as opposed to focus being on the hostage. And so the demands that this individual is going to give us are going to be get back, get away, get those cops out of here, get me a car, I want to get out of here, etc.
Okay.
The demands for in scenario B are going to be either not there at all or they're going to be nonsensical. And that is because in scenario B, he has everything he wants. We can't facilitate anything for him. In scenario A, in theory, if we wanted to, we could provide him a car. In theory, if we wanted to, we could remove officers from the scene, move back, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Is the scenario B the because of the former romantic relationship, typically these people want to reestablish the intimate relationship, or like I say, want the reasons for taking a hostage when I kind of are either, you know, they want their children, they want their relationship back, or they want money for some other reason.
It's usually because they suffered some kind of loss. They either lost the relationship with the person they're holding, or the person they're holding took their kids from them. But usually people go into a crisis state when they have suffered recent and multiple losses.
I think in cases, in most cases like that, they're upset because they've lost control. They've lost control of the person they've abused.
Sure. And that constitutes a loss of faith, right?
Exactly.
They lose their self-worth. They lose their self-esteem because the person, and you get the cliched, if I can't have you, no one will.
Exactly.
Yes.
Well, in a situations like that, Derek, you're working on the reactive end of it. Does your company or you as a negotiator, is there something you can do proactively for, let's say, conflict resolution in a domestic violence situation? How can we prevent it from getting to that point? And do you work on that end of it?
As a negotiator, I don't, but I know that I have colleagues in the criminal investigation world who are versed in handling domestic violence cases, and they work with counselors and victims in putting together safety plans and mediating these types of issues between partners, husband, wife, whatever, on a regular basis. As a negotiator, I don't get involved in that aspect of it, but I can speak to it being available to folks either through government services or through the detectives that are assigned special cases that involve domestic violence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are all of these, whether it be the crazy, the criminal, the crusader, are just about all of them amenable to negotiation no matter what the situation is? Or would you say, you know, one is just so volatile, or the one that has mental health problems, those are the ones that usually go bad in the end? Or what can you say about, can you negotiate any of these situations?
We will make the attempt to negotiate any of those situations. Are we going to be able to get everybody out all the time? No. I told you the success rate was 93%. That means 7% or 6% of the time, it goes in a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not 100% foolproof, but as long as I can get somebody on the phone, I've got a shot at mitigating the damage that's been done already.
Yeah. Well, while you're on the phone with them, are they, and of course you can't be talking back and forth with your colleagues, are you looking at the dry erase board? Are you looking at their computer in terms of the other people collecting the information? How do you communicate with your colleagues when you're actively on the phone with the...
Sure. You know? Great question.
Yeah.
So the dry erase board, the situation boards that we use, are kept updated constantly throughout the course of the incident, and so any significant changing dynamic is placed up on the situation board. But the coach is the filter of all information that goes to the primary. So the coach has got one ear attuned to the speaker where the negotiation is coming out of, and they've got an earpiece in, and they are communicating via radio or cell phone with persons on the outside of the negotiation room about information that is coming in. And when there's something that's relevant, for example, we want to let him know that his mom is outside and she's worried about it. Okay? And so that's simply what the coach will write down on a sticky note, pass it over to the primary, and at the appropriate time of the conversation, the primary will inject that into the dialogue. So that's how the information gets passed. That's one of the ways. The other way is when there's a natural break in the dialogue. He hangs up. It gets disconnected for whatever reason. When it's appropriate, we will call. We'll call a timeout, and we will all huddle together, talk about where we were, where we are, and where we intend to go with not only the dialogue but the overall management of the entity.
Huh. I see. When victims are in that situation, whether they're the clerk at the convenience store or some other scenarios, a couple things. what should that person do when they're the person being held hostage to, so that it doesn't escalate, you know, to murder? And are there certain things that the person being taken hostage, are there things that they definitely should not say to them, or if they're trying to establish a rapport and you're the expert that knows what to say? I mean, how do you advise us on those matters?
Sure. So some things that to remember if, God forbid, you're ever taken hostage is, number one, the main goal is you got to survive, and mm-hmm. one of the ways that helps in that regard is positive self-talk. Tell yourself over and over and over and over, I'm going to survive no matter what. I'm going to survive no matter what. It programs your brain into a particular point of view that has an impact on not only your attitude but your physical reaction to whatever is going to occur. The second thing I would say is accept your lot in life. Accept the fact that you're in this situation. Be patient and be prepared to wait. And it's easy for me to say here on the phone with you, but try not to get discouraged. You know, if it takes us 10 minutes to get you released as a hostage, I would submit to you that's probably 10 minutes too long. And so it's going to appear at times that it's moving slowly, that we're not doing enough, we're not listening, et cetera. But these things, they take time. When we get on the scene, the first thing that we want to do is try to, what we say in the business, is slow things down. The first 15 to 45 minutes of any incident is the most volatile, it's the most chaotic, and it's the most dangerous. So what we're trying to do is put the brakes on the incident, to slow it down, to bring it to a pace that's manageable. Because, again, he's taking hostages, or she, I don't want to be discriminatory, he or she is taking hostages, and they're in crisis, and police are coming, people are yelling, people are screaming, and I'm in a situation I've never prepared for before in my life, and it's overwhelming, and that's when accidents can happen. So we're going to try to put the brakes on it sooner rather than later. As law enforcement, we physically will contain a crisis site, which means we're just going to surround the building, wherever its location is taking place. That's a physical containment of the crisis site. As a negotiator, we practice what's called verbal containment, and that is simply getting that person on the phone as soon as possible. Because if they're talking to me, what are they not doing?
Good point. they're not causing
me,
more trouble.
They're not harming anybody. They're not fortifying their position. They're not setting up, use your imagination. They're not setting up booby traps. They're not shooting at us. I mean, I guess they could, but history has shown that they don't. If they're on the phone. So we try to establish that verbal containment as soon as possible. But back to your original question, try to follow the instructions as much as possible. They're going to tell you move here, move there, and follow it as much as you can. Try not to become confrontational with these folks. Remember that they're the ones that are in control, so the less confrontation you put their way, the more you minimize that they will react in a negative way, either against you as a hostage or against other folks. Try to observe what's going on and make mental notes. Remember that it's a hostage situation, but it's also what? That's for you.
Oh, it's
a hostage situation, but it's also
I'm
what?
I'm sorry. Repeat, please.
It's also an emotional.
It's also a crime scene.
Yes.
So
okay.
At some point, an investigator is going to want to talk to you about what went on the inside. So
be observant.
Part of you wresting some of that control from the hostage taker is becoming an active participant in making sure that when this thing is over, he gets the punishment he deserves. So I'm going to take good mental notes about who he called, where he sat, what he said, if an assault took place, who was assaulted, and keep those mental notes in the back of your mind. And that's a good survival technique as well.
It keeps you occupied from losing control emotionally as well, right?
Exactly. And probably one of the biggest things I can impart upon the listeners is when we come in, if we're coming in for a rescue, face down on the ground as soon as we hit the door. Ordinarily, the shock and the speed and the surprise of what we do usually causes the bad guys to stand up and turn towards wherever they hear the noise. You guys hit the ground, anybody that's left standing is going to get challenged by the law enforcement officers that are coming through the door or the window or the wall in some cases. And you touched on this, Donna, earlier when you first asked me the question, is I'm never going to tell someone who's being held hostage, don't negotiate for your own relief. I will tell you, because there's going to be a time period before we get there, the average response time on the best day is going to be 30 minutes to an hour before all the specialized people get there. Mm-hmm. Patrol officers will get there within 2 to 3 minutes of the incident. But the people with the special training, the negotiators and the SWAT operators, 30, 60 minutes is usually the window. I'm not going to tell you that in that 30 to 60 minute time window that you shouldn't negotiate for your own release, because you're going to have the opportunity to do that. What I will say is that once we become involved, once we've made contact with that guy on the inside, leave it up to us.
Mm-hmm. Well, if a person finds themselves in that situation, Derek, what are, you know, some quick bullet pointers? What should you say? What should you not say? How should you act towards the hostage taker? I mean, what do you do?
Not to accelerate it, yeah.
Yeah. To not push him over the edge.
Did you hear, do you know who Antoinette Tough is?
No.
Antoinette Tough is an employee of the school in Decatur, Georgia, who was on the phone with Georgia authorities during their school shooting a few days ago.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Remarkable. Remarkable lady. Untrained, unprepared for one of the most horrific things that can happen to anybody, a shooter coming into a school building. And she, without any training, just demonstrated empathy for this guy. He says to her, "I'm all alone. My life is screwed up. Nobody loves me." She says, "Well, I love you, and we're going to get through this thing together." That simple gesture was enough to start to turn this guy off, slow this thing down. So the short answer to your question, Delilah, is however you do it, you demonstrate an understanding of why they're in this current situation. One of the first questions that I would ask is, what happened? How did you get here today?
Mm-hmm.
You ask that question in that fashion, and the majority of the people are going to what I term begin to dump their bucket. Mm-hmm. And they're going to tell you that I was released from prison 3 weeks ago. I maintained a heroin my heroin addiction while I was in prison. I'm trying to get off of that. I can't get hired for a job. I went to the clinic to get a prescription for methadone to help me kick this heroin habit. I didn't have the $25 copay, so I'm back here robbing a business because that's what I know how to do best. That's how I know how to get money. I can't function in society the way they want me to, so I'm going to go back to what I know. And that was an actual incident that we worked, and that was a question that the negotiator posed, is, hey, how did we get here today to this point where there's 50 cops surrounding a location where you're holding 12 people hostage? And that was the beginning of our establishing rapport. So one of the first.
And that opens the door for like a long scenario, right? And that'll give you time to do other things behind the scene instead of just asking more open-ended questions rather than like yes, no, or whatever.
Absolutely, absolutely. We're framing the scope of the discussion, but still giving them the latitude to answer how they want to answer. And many of these folks just, they haven't had somebody who has taken the time to listen.
Right. Well, I have a couple other things regarding what you just said. Derek, I'm wondering, with the scenario where the hostage is in there and say it's a group of people, does it bode well if somebody in the group makes a request regarding their comfort or something? In other words, they show compassion. And maybe that's a positive thing. And then on the other side of it, what if they're just constantly making demands of you? I want a helicopter. I want a pizza. I want this. I want, you know, and that has to be within 10 minutes or whatever. So can you address both of those?
Well, it depends on where we are in the negotiations process, and it depends on the reasonableness of the demand.
Okay.
If I'm at a position where he's going to start issuing demands, then the emotional level is starting to come down a little bit, and now he's pushing the discussion into the arena of bargaining, and so it depends on the demand. If I'm in that area to bargain, if there's bargaining to be done, and the request is made for a pizza, then I am on safer ground to admit the quid pro quo. Yes, I'll give you a pizza, but I need something in return.
Okay.
And it doesn't have
I need
to
a wife for a pizza? Does that seem equitable?
It may not be a life. It may be I need you to put the pin back in the explosive device. Can you do that for me? You know, I'm not asking you to come out. I'm not asking you to release anybody now. I'm asking you, can you do that for me? Or here's a better example. I had a guy on the bridge that was threatening to jump. He was we call them SWAMI. SWAMI is an acronym for suicide with other motivations, meaning he's intimating his suicidal intent. But the act of suicide is not his true motivating factor. He's out to manipulate. This is a manipulative person. And very early in the negotiation, he asked me for a cup of coffee with Irish cream flavoring and a packet of Sweet 'n Low. And I said, I'll bark that up the chain to see what they say. I can't make that decision in a vacuum, but I know that they're going to want something from you in return. I'm not asking you to come down off that ledge. At the point that I was talking to him, he had both feet. He was seated on the barricade, and he had both feet dangling over the water. And I said, I'm not asking you to come down, but what I am asking you to do is swing one leg over and put one foot on the deck or on this side. Can you do that for me? And he agreed. Was that a big concession? Not really, but what I got from him was a public display of commitment. So when I ask him in the future to commit, he's going to be more obligated because he's already committed. Does that make sense?
Right.
Because
even though he didn't get the coffee yet, he had confidence that you were going to do that.
Yes, and I did bring him the coffee, and I got him his Irish cream flavoring, and I got him his sweetened milk.
Yeah.
And so that was a way for me to start to build rapport with him. And because he made that commitment earlier to me, any commitment that he made to me in the future, he wanted to stay consistent with, because people love to be viewed as consistent. And so it went a long way into helping us to build that rapport.
Bad pun, Derek. You had a leg up on the situation. Bad pun. Sorry, I had to say that. But you know, this is just really fascinating. I wish we had more time. You're going to have to come back. You know, now you're part of the Shattered Lives family. Listen, I wondered. We have about 13 minutes left. Can we segue a little bit into the aftermath after you've de-escalated the situation, and there's, you know, the hostage is in custody or whatnot, or the victims are released or whatnot. Talk about, you know, do you have a chance to interface with the victims? What's it like in terms of the aftermath for this kind of a situation? How is that dealt with?
Okay, immediately after, okay, let's say we have a hostage that's released. But the incident is still ongoing.
Uh-huh.
The hostage comes to us. When I say us, I mean the negotiations team, and we debrief them, and we get as much information about what's going on inside the crisis site as possible. And then they are handed off to our detective bureau, and the detectives begin to interview them about what they saw and heard that can establish the eventual charges that will be placed against the individual on the inside. But more importantly than that is we set up a protocol by which we have mental health counselors that are versed in critical incident stress debriefing that are attached to our negotiations team. And so when my phone activates notifying me that we have an incident, their phones are going off at the same time. So they respond as a part of our team, knowing that they're going to have, number one, released hostages that they're going to have to immediately debrief with their mental health talent, and then, in addition, family members that will arrive at the scene who are going to be what? Guess what? In a state of crisis as well. And
right.
So those mental health professionals begin critical incident stress debriefing immediately on the scene with released hostages and family members. Family members of not just the hostages that are being held, but family members of the person doing the whole
thing. Of the perpetrator,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. They show up and they are in a frenzy as well. And so we've got procedures in place to deal with that. Now, later on down the line, we have gone back and touched base with the persons that were being held to see how they were feeling, to see if there's anything else that they could tell us about the incident that will help us do our job a little bit better. Because they have it doesn't happen every day, and hostages have a unique insight into what we do and how it's viewed on the inside and what was effective and what they thought was crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's short-term emotional reactions that they're going to have to deal with, and that's what the mental health people talk to them about. And then there's the long-term effects that they'll have to deal with because it's probably one of the most traumatic incidents that they'll ever go through. I mean, you have a total loss of control of your own life and your own freedom, and you're being held at risk of violence for an extended period of time. So there's going to take some time to recover from that. So that's what our mental health people help them to try to deal with.
And then is it common that these incidents do eventually go to court and that the victims do have to participate in that aspect?
Yes. So the victims will have to testify in court about what they saw, heard, observed, and were subjected to while they were on the inside. And that causes them to be re-victimized. They have to deal with the flashbacks and the experiences that they went through 6, 9, 10 months, 12 months earlier, all over again. But most government agencies, most jurisdictions have very confident witness victim advocates that are good at helping walk those folks through the process, preparing them for what they're going to hear and see. I don't think that the people in the Washington metropolitan area have a chokehold on that. I think that most worth their weight in salt have similar witness victim advocates to help deal with the aftermath.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Derek? What things do you do to de-escalate your own emotional tense? You know, you've been in a tense situation as well. And how do you come down from something like that?
Right.
Good question. So when you come down hard. You crash. I have worked jobs that have gone 12, 13, 14 hours up to I've worked a job that went 27 hours. Now, I wasn't on scene for all 27 hours because that's humanly impossible. But when it's over, you're no longer running on the adrenaline of the incident, and you crash, and you're out, and you don't want to move, you don't want to think, you don't want to talk, you just want to vegetate and then eventually fall asleep. But what we do is we debrief as a team. Not only the operational and the administrative aspects of the incident, what we did right, what we did wrong, but the emotions that are tied to it. I've worked in an incident where the bad guy, we had to use deadly force against the bad guy. And it was the first time that I had two negotiators. Let me back up. The negotiators work in pairs. It's always a coach and a primary.
Mm-hmm.
So because this guy, his phone conversation with us was intermittent, so we had to go up front with voice amplifying devices, and we had to use other technical means to talk to him. And so I had two negotiators on the phone. I had two negotiators up front in an armored personnel carrier, and I had two negotiators at another location that had a microphone attached to it as well as a camera, and they were trying to negotiate. So I had three different points, six negotiators who were trying to negotiate with this guy, and all six of them either witnessed or heard us taking a deadly force action against this individual. And I've never had six people exposed to the death of another human being before. I've never even heard of it happening before.
Wow.
And so it bothered some of them. It bothered some of them because most of them were relatively new negotiators at the time. And so we took painstaking measures to make sure that they had the critical incident stress debriefers available to them whenever they called. Even if it was 3:00 in the morning, they woke up in a cold sweat and couldn't sleep because they were flashing back to that incident. We had CISM people on call ready for them at any time because we knew it was a very unique. So we debrief as a team as close to the incident as we possibly can just to hash out what we thought about what happened, how we felt about what happened. Are we harboring any feelings about what happened that indicates that we are placing blame on ourselves?
Yeah, well, that sounds very good because, you know, there's so much. It's like the domino effect, and the aftermath affects everyone in the scenario. So I think that's so important. Can you tell me, you know, this comes down to one-to-one, plain old-fashioned good communication. And, you know, you're on the phone, but in the advent of the age of technology, how much does technology play into this versus you just being a very good person-to-person communicator?
The overall management of the incident, we there are various technical assets that we bring to bear. I won't divulge those here, but there are various technical assets that we bring to bear on a particular crisis site. But the technology has thrown us a curveball that we're still struggling to catch up with, and that is the number of cell phones that are available, and not only the number of cell phones, but the number of cell phone service providers. Before, when we would arrive on the scene, there were three companies that I needed to call to knock out phone service to the crisis site so that they had to talk to us, couldn't talk to anybody else. And now, it's 10, 15, 20 different places I have to call before I can narrow down the service provider for either the cell we're trying to capture or the landline that we're trying to capture. There have been recent incidents in the media where individuals are barricaded in a location, negotiating with the police, and then they're on Facebook posting what's going on. So now we've got to get with the Facebook security people to have them knock out the Facebook services for the individual that we're dealing with. So there's so many other considerations that we have to take now that we didn't take in the past.
We're gonna have to start negotiating. It sounds so challenging. Wow.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
It certainly is. Are there, in terms of geography and jurisdiction and all of that, I know off air we talked about a little bit about where you've done training, but are most big cities equipped with the kinds of teams that you manage and put together and companies such as yourself with Black Swan, or can you speak to that a little bit? We've got about 3 minutes.
Yeah, I think most major metropolitan areas have very capable negotiation responses. And I don't think that when you get into the middle of the country or maybe some of the smaller jurisdictions, I'll give you an example. There are a lot of small township jurisdictions in Pennsylvania and New Jersey that perform under a regional umbrella because their agencies are so small. But most major metropolitan areas have the capabilities to effectively manage hostage barricade incidents and provide training for their people.
Well, that's comforting to know. If there was a singular message that you wanted to convey to our audience with respect to the topics that we've covered, and maybe, I really do seriously would like to have you back on some other areas. What would you say with regard to, message about the topics that you've covered this evening?
A couple of things. Don't think that negotiators have full dominion and control over any crisis event that occurs. It's a team effort. With different players bringing different talents to the table in order to address the incident, and the primary negotiator is just a small part of that. And the other takeaway is be patient if you find yourself involved in a hostage situation, whether you're actually taken hostage or you have a loved one that's taken hostage. A lot of our negotiating is done with family members, because they don't understand why it's taking us so long. They don't understand why the primary is talking about the bad guys feeling so much when they're holding their loved one in there. But the process takes a lot of time, and patience is the word of the day on the part of not only law enforcement, but the people on the inside and the people who are related to those on the inside.
Well, that only makes sense that you have to negotiate with them. Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to close out for this evening, but please do keep in touch with me, Derek. We're going to have a detailed blog tomorrow or so, and I want to encourage everyone to go to www.donnagore.com and imagine publicity.com. And be sure to tune in to Shattered Lives next week from South Carolina. So thank you, everyone, and I'll say good evening. And
thank you, Donna.
Keep in touch. Okay, thank you, Derek, and thank you, Delilah.
Good night.
Bye, Delilah.
Good night.
Bye-bye.